You could win an audio DVD of every presentation from all six Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences. Record your answer to the question, Issues Etc. What does this mean? On our comment line, 618-223-8382. If we play your answer during Issues Etc., we'll send you a conference audio DVD of almost 50 hours of teaching. 618-223-8382 and answer the question, Issues Etc., what does this mean? Please be sure to mention where you listen.
Is being gay a perversion?
Senator, I'm going to give you the same answer I just gave you previously. My respect for every individual, regardless of their sexual orientation, is the same.
You name me any person who is against us today, I want to say that person is not our permanent enemy. That's a precious human being made in the image and likeness of God, someone who's got a conscience that we can appeal to somewhere in there, and our job should be to win him or her over.
You might have a terrible pharmacist, but the antibiotics are still going to cure the infection. And the same thing with church. The sacraments and the word and all the blessings that we receive from Christ through his church, those are too precious. Those are too valuable to give up, even though you've been wrong.
This is Bill, the bug guy, and I love listening to Issues Etc. every day while I spray bugs.
The stereotype is that it is the conservative out there who is constantly moralizing in the public square. He's out there constantly trying to change people's behavior. Now, there certainly is some of that going on, but the moralizing in the American social landscape nowadays is also coming from the left, and it's coming from the left in a very toxic way. How is it that the left, progressive America, is so deeply moralizing? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Wednesday afternoon, April the 18th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the moralizing of the American left. John Daniel Davidson, senior correspondent for The Federalist, will be our guest. We'll spend some time with Lyman Stone, an advisor at Demographics Intelligent and an economist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, about some birth rate increases in Poland and in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Two different approaches, one formal, one informal, to increase the birth rate. Why? And does it have any application to America as in a developed country, or maybe even to the church as well? Then in hour two of Issues Etc., it's time for listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line. That comment line number you could use anytime, wherever, whenever you listen, 618-223-8382. The email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Joining us on this Wednesday afternoon to talk about the moralizing of the American left, John Daniel Davidson. He's senior correspondent at The Federalist and author of a recent column there titled Blame the Left for the Rise of Moralizing in America. John, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
What's the difference, kind of the crucial difference, between being moral and moralizing?
Right. Well, being moral is really just about trying to be a good person by helping others, by improving your own behavior. And it requires humility and a recognition of your own moral failings. And it requires tolerance of other people. And that's really the opposite of what moralizing is. Moralizing is trying to tell other people what to do out of a misguided belief that you have a monopoly on the truth and you have a moral duty to impose that truth on other people. You know, so moralizing is very outward focused, and it invites intolerance, and in its worst, most extreme forms, it invites tyranny.
Give us an example or two, if you could, of how the American left moralizes.
Well, you see it in so many different forms and in a lot of different ways lately, from things like, you know, boycotting organizations that have a relationship with the NRA to demanding that people be fired for having conservative views. The first big instance of that years ago now was Brendan Eich at Mozilla. But since then, we've seen this over and over again, shouting the conservative speakers down on college campuses and in some cases attacking them. This is sort of a feature of the American left, and it's born out of this righteous indignation that those who disagree with them are morally culpable, are wicked, are wrong, and need to be silenced.
So you mentioned the example of the comical and cartoon character from the famous, now famous, cartoon series The Simpsons, Apu. He is the Indian owner of, if I'm not mistaken, the Quickie Mart there in the mythical Springfield. How has he recently come in for, or the creators and producers of The Simpsons, how has he recently come in for criticism?
Sure. This happened a few weeks ago, and I talk about it in the piece. An Indian-American comedian apparently has been very offended at The Simpsons and the character of Apu for many years, and in November of last year made a documentary about it called The Problem with Apu. And recently an episode of The Simpsons sort of subtly addressed this claim that Apu is a racist stereotype, with a scene of Marge reading Lisa a bedtime story that was anodyne and politically correct and very boring, as most politically correct things are. But it sort of reignited this controversy over the character of Apu, who is voiced by a white actor, which was one of the reasons that this Indian-American comedian had such a problem with it. But it shows the difference, I think. It illustrates the difference between being moral and moralized that we talked about earlier. If you're offended by Apu and you don't like the depiction of Apu as an Indian-American in the show The Simpsons, and for whatever reason you think it's offensive, instead of, berating the creators of The Simpsons and making a documentary about how you're offended and why you're offended, just go out and make your own show and portray Indian Americans the way you think they should be portrayed. Don't try to get a character kicked off a show you have nothing to do with and try to gin up moral outrage over something that you're offended by. That's moralizing. And that is what we increasingly see the left doing in all areas of the culture.
You also cite an example of law professor Josh Blackman's recent visit. I saw this unfolding live via Twitter, if I'm not mistaken. A recent visit to a New York law school. What happened there?
Yeah, he was invited by the Federalist Society to give a talk on free speech on campus. And Josh Blackman, by the way, is a brilliant legal scholar who's done really great work on Obamacare and on other recent legal issues around DACA and things like that. He's a really smart guy, a really interesting speaker and writer, and somebody that these law school students should really have been coming to learn from, not to protest. But anyway, word got it, some article he wrote for National Review was passed around campus, an article in which he praised the president's rescinding of DACA. And it provoked sort of a social justice mob that met him at his Federalist Society talk with signs denouncing him as a racist. They attempted to shout him down, to hound him from the room, to shut down the talk. And the reason I brought it up is because the way he handled it is the way you have to handle moralizing people. He stood his ground, he engaged them in debate, and when it became clear that they weren't really interested in debate, they were only interested in silencing him, once they realized they weren't going to be able to silence him, they just left. And that's really what we need. We need to stand up to moralizing people and hold our ground, and not, as so many college administrators do, buckle at the first sign of pressure and issue these simpering apologies. That emboldens the moralizing left. It doesn't and will never check them.
Why do college administrations, almost without exception, as you say, coddle the moralizing student protesters?
I think it's a knee-jerk reaction in a lot of cases to any kind of administrator, to avoid conflict, to try to put out the fires with the least amount of effort possible. And I think that a lot of administrators have this knee-jerk reaction thinking that it'll be sufficient, that this will be fine, that this will sort of solve the problem. What they don't realize is that every time they do that, they embolden student activists in the case of sort of campus activism, to take the next step, to take another step, to occupy the president's office, to issue ridiculous demands. A bunch of students at Duke University interrupted the president's speech to an alumni group, stormed the stage with megaphones, and read off a list of outrageous demands in front of these alumni, many of whom turned their backs or walked out. But this is the sort of behavior that's becoming normal on college campuses, and it's becoming normal because administrators don't stand up and speak against it and hold their ground, and in cases where it's needed, hold students accountable.
So the tactic here is not simply to chide or to condemn or to express outrage. It is often simply to, and many times without any substantiation whatsoever, to simply call names, bigot, the kind of names that carry the heavy moral weight in the American social fabric, bigot, homophobe, whatever it may be, whatever phobe is being tossed out there. How do we engage that?
Well, I think we have to understand that the purpose of using those words is to delegitimize and silence their opponents. If you are a racist or a bigot or a xenophobe or a homophobe, your views and whatever you have to say about anything really is not legitimate, and it's not welcome in the public square. That's the purpose of using those words. It's to silence and to eliminate, really, the speech and arguments and ideas they disagree with, rather than engaging those ideas and arguments on their own terms and having an open debate. I think what we need to do in response to that, as I said with the case of Josh Blackman, hold your ground even in the face of these ugly words. Josh Blackman isn't a racist. He's not a white supremacist. And yet those were the homemade signs that he was greeted with by these law school students, right? These were law school students who, you know, have a lot to learn from someone like Josh Blackman. He did the right thing. He stood his ground and wasn't intimidated by these labels, because the labels are really there precisely to intimidate.
Do the labels also often betray the fact that in the case of the student protesters, they simply do not know what ideas they think they're protesting?
I think that's true. I think a lot of times student protesters will protest a speaker without having engaged really any of the ideas or writings of that speaker. Certainly is the case with students who protested and then attacked Charles Murray. Very few of those students, I would venture to say none of them, have seriously engaged Charles Murray's work in a significant way. I think that's common. They attack because they've been told and they believe that this person is a racist. And for a lot of people on the left, it's enough to be a racist simply to support a strong border policy, or to have voted for Donald Trump, or to be pro-life, or any number of a range of conservative opinions or right-of-center opinions is enough to warrant the label racist for a lot of the folks on the left, and especially these student activists.
And in certain cases, I'm thinking about Evergreen State College, even the left becomes the target of left's moralizing.
That's right. Insufficient devotion to the cause, so to speak. And the case of the biology professor at Evergreen State is a perfect example. His crime was that he showed up to campus on a day when the students had decreed that no white people should come to campus. This is easy to sort of laugh at from a conservative's perspective, you know, sort of the left eating itself. But I think we need to be concerned about that, because the intolerance, even toward their own, is indicative of a larger impulse on the left that has, in different countries and at different times in history, worked itself out in very violent and disastrous ways.
John Daniel Davidson is our guest. We're talking about the moralizing of the American left. He's senior correspondent for The Federalist. When we come back, he says that progressivism is at its heart a savior complex. We'll find out what he means.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. AdGruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at AdGruesome.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
You could win an audio DVD of every presentation from all six Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences. Record your answer to the question, Issues Etc., What Does This Mean? On our comment line, 618-223-8382. If we play your answer during Issues Etc., we'll send you a conference audio DVD of almost 50 hours of teaching. 618-223-8382 and answer the question, Issues Etc., What Does This Mean? Please be sure to mention where you listen. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the moralizing of the American left. John Daniel Davidson of The Federalist is our guest. John, you say that progressivism is at its heart a savior complex. What do you mean by that?
I mean, at heart, progressivism, and especially American-style progressivism, has as its project, its long-term overarching goal, the perfection of society. And conservatives, by contrast, don't believe the perfection of society is possible and accept a kind of tragic view of the world and of human nature and a limitation on what's possible. Progressives don't accept that. They think that perfection is possible. And if perfection is possible, then they're willing to go to any lengths to achieve that perfection. And, you know, progressives today are very skilled at sort of denying their intellectual forebears, by which I'm referring to the eugenicists of the mid and early 20th century, who believed you could perfect society by eugenics, something that every civilized person would disagree with vociferously now. But that's the overarching goal of progressives, is to progress toward a perfect society and to implement it by force if necessary.
You cite as an example Woodrow Wilson, as the story is told in a recent biography of him that you have reviewed. What's the story there?
Well, Woodrow Wilson was sort of the father of American progressivism, and as our first truly progressive president, he used the powers at his disposal to great effect. He was sort of a infamous moralizer, even before he became president. He was the son of a Presbyterian minister, and he saw his job as president to enact policies for the benefit of the country. And if you disagreed with him, if you opposed his policies, he would denounce you as either a fool or a traitor, which he did on many occasions, both to Democrats and Republican opponents in Congress. And the sort of framework that he approached the use of power with led him to abuses of power during World War I. Cracking down on newspapers and media outlets that didn't toe the line that his administration wanted on the war effort. He wasn't shy about using the enormous powers of the presidency to silence his opponents. And he did so with a clear conscience, because in his mind, he was doing what was good for the country, whether the country knew it or not.
There is a kind of moralizing, as you point out earlier in your piece for The Federalist, that
seeks to change the behavior of others. But it strikes me that the moralizing of the left isn't really interested in any behavior except not improving the morals of their neighbors, so to speak, but simply silencing their neighbors with whom they disagree.
Yeah, that's right. It's not so much maybe about persuasion. I don't think that the goal is persuasion, especially when you're working to silence somebody. The goal is to silence them and to render their ideas illegitimate and out of bounds. The behavior that we're talking about, I think, you know, wanting people to change their behavior and forcing people to change their behavior, I think has to do with the discrete policy priorities of the American left right now. And that means imposing through state and federal law a requirement to acknowledge and support, you know, things like transgenderism or same-sex marriage. And I think they're willing to go to any means to do this. And we see this in different states. You know, policies come up. If you don't support the transgender agenda, then you will not be qualified, for instance, to be a foster parent in certain states. The goal is not tolerance. It's not live and let live. It is toe the line, accept our ideas and our ideology, or you will be banished, you will be silenced. And if they can, I think that they would prevent many people who don't share their views from being able to engage in certain professions. You know, you can't practice law, you can't practice medicine. I think that's coming. I think at least attempts to do that are coming. It's the logical extension of American progressivism right now.
Finally, then, there's kind of a different quality to these protests than America has experienced before. There was certainly a moralizing quality to the protests that swept the country in the latter part of the mid-20th century. They were war protests. They were protests against presidential candidates. These don't seem as informed. These seem to be far quicker to deride things like the First Amendment and free speech. I'm sitting here and I'm saying, okay, what does the future hold if these people actually manage to graduate from college and become citizen voters? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, it's a scary prospect. I think the failure begins with our education system. You know, you have high school students who are going on into college and going all the way through college and graduating without any grasp of what the First Amendment is or why the Constitution matters, of what, you know, natural rights are, of what a free society should be, and why we have worked so hard to create a free society and to defend it. If you don't understand those things, if you don't know anything about them, if you don't know anything about the alternatives, about fascist Germany or the Soviet Union, then socialism, you know, can seem like a good idea. Eradicating the First Amendment can seem like a good idea. But the solution, I think, is to redouble our efforts to make sure that high school students and college students learn this stuff, that they learn a little bit of the history of their country, that they learn about the Constitution, they learn about the Bill of Rights, and they understand what's at stake, because the stakes really couldn't be any higher.
John Daniel Davidson is senior correspondent at The Federalist and author of a recent column titled Blame the Left for the Rise of Moralizing in America. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. John, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, Lyman Stone, advisor to demographic intelligence, is going to join us to talk about a birth rate increase in both Poland and the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. How did they do it, and how does it bear upon the birth rate in the United States? Stay tuned.
Well, I think one thing we're going to do right out of the gate is define what pro-life is.
Scott Klusendorf talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That term is now being confused. It's being put up for grabs, and we're going to make clear what the pro-life syllogism is, how we can make that case for life with people who don't accept biblical authority, who maybe don't even know what it is we stand for and are subject to being confused. So there's a crying need to clarify what pro-life means, what our actual arguments are, and then we'll look at five bad ways people argue against the pro-life case in the public square so that we can be prepared to give good, solid, Christ-honoring answers.
You can meet and hear Scott Klusendorf making the case for life at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Learn more about conference speakers and topics and register at issuesetc.org.
Oh, Lord, open my lips.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
At Concordia Evangelical Lutheran Church of Wilmington, Delaware, our mission is to serve our community by sharing Christian hope. We've been doing this since 1938 and joyfully continue to do so in the 21st century. If you're ever in the city that DuPont Chemical Corporation calls home, or is known by some as the credit card capital of the world, we hope you visit to receive Jesus through His Word and Sacrament. Otherwise, check us out on the web at ConcordiaWilmington.com.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.